We're doing the Yaakov. We're up to page Tes Amud Aleph in the standard editions, which is Chaf Yimla Amud Aleph in the Gemara. We're about to enter a very interesting sugiya, very interesting discussion in the Talmud. We have a concept called Darshinan Taima Dikra, which is a very complex subject, and now we're about to see it up front. What does it mean, Darshinan Taima Dikra? So, the Torah gives us 613 mitzvot. Many more, but there are 613 overt mitzvot, okay? And then, we look at these mitzvot, we try to understand a certain system. We're trying to understand the logic in the mitzvot. So some mitzvot are intuitive. You can understand, it says don't steal, don't kill. Okay, I understand. It says honor your parents, I understand. Fear your parents, I understand. Then the Torah comes and says keep Shabbos, but then tells you why you should keep Shabbos. It says, I want you to remember I created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. Okay, I understand. It tells you I took you out of Egypt, there you were servants, there were your slaves, you were working, now you're going to rest. I understand. Now the Torah comes and says, when you take collateral, don't take someone's livelihood as collateral. You gave him a loan, he's a taxi driver, don't take his taxi away as collateral because he needs it as his livelihood. I can understand. Now the Torah says, you give a loan to someone poor. When you take collateral, don't take his cover. If you're going to take his cover, you got to bring it back every night so he could cover himself when he goes to sleep at night. I understand. Then the Torah says, if you give a loan to a widow, I don't want you to take her garment. I don't want you to take her garment. Why did the Torah say that? So we would say, maybe because she's poor. And if you take it, you'll always have to come back and forth, and then people speak badly about her. Why does she have this guy come to her house every day? He keeps bringing her back her garment. You know, let's say it's a garment she wears by day. You bring it there by day. You pick it up at night as collateral. Or let's say it's her cover. It's not nice. People are going to see it. But wait, it didn't say that in the Torah. And that's not obvious. And what would happen if you have a super wealthy widow next door who happens to be, you're at the supermarket and she needs a loan. And she tells you, look, all my money's tied up in CDs right now. In a short time, I'll be able to pay you back. I'm just short on cash. But you know, her Rolls Royce in the front yard. So can you take a garment from her? No one's going to say, you know, she's poor now. She's still driving around in her Rolls Royce. She just needed some cash. If I'm going to attribute a logic to the mitzvah, I can be limiting to the mitzvah. So sometimes we can see an idea in the mitzvah and say, okay, the Torah is teaching me this concept. The question is, can I take it a step further? Can I give a reasoning to a mitzvah that will then define where the mitzvah is applicable in instances where the Torah didn't clearly tell me that? That's the question. And that is the question of Darshinan Taima Dikra. Can I look at a pasuk and give a reasoning to it where that reasoning will carry halachic weight? That is a machlokas. The machlokas is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is the opinion that says we can give such a reasoning. So again, on a philosophical level, we always give reasons for mitzvos. We're trying to understand what type of human being the Torah is developing in us. Where is the Torah driving us? But on a halachic level, do I discuss reasons for mitzvos where the Torah didn't give them? Right? That's the question. You guys with me? The question of Darshinan Taima Dikra. Do we also derive reasons for psukim where we don't have a reason within the pasuk? Rabbi Shimon holds you may, and using that line of reasoning, we begin the next Gemara. Tanya, we have a braisa. Amar Rabbi Shimon. Who is Rabbi Shimon in the Shas? Shas Mishnayos. Whenever you encounter Rabbi Shimon plainly, that's going to be Rashbi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. The plain Rabbi Shimon in Mishnah is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. He is the one that holds their Shinan Taima Dikra. That when the Torah says, don't take a garment from a widow, that's only a poor widow. Torah doesn't say that. But he says, right, you don't want to be masila shem bishchenoteha. You don't want to give her a bad reputation among the neighbors. And if she's a wealthy widow, she ain't getting a bad reputation because he won't have to come back and forth and bring her back her garment. She's got others. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai gives a reasoning and then gives a halachic implication from the reasoning. So now we have this braisa. We learned we have a biblical mitzvah of pe'ah. Leave over the corner of your field for the poor, right? Yes, if you're growing wheat, if you're growing grapes, you got to leave over a corner, right? Yeah. We have many, many items that can grow, many different foods that we would leave over pe'ah for. So when the Torah describes leaving over pe'ah, the Torah says, lo techale, don't finish harvesting your field. That's an indication that the place I leave over the corner is the final corner. One could say, I will partition off a corner when I start harvesting the field. And there's good reason to think that way, because we find in other mitzvos, the Torah says, don't eat your fruit till you give the Kohen Truma, till you give Bikurim to the temple, to the Kohen. Your first animal goes to the Kohen. Your firstborn son must be redeemed from the Kohen. This is a recurring theme in Torah, that the first is taken off, Truma, Maiser, Isho, Maiser, Sheni, right? And suddenly here the Torah says, leave over for the poor the final corner at the end. Lo techale pe'atzadecha bekutzrecha. As you harvest your field, don't leave over, don't finish off the last corner. Why did the Torah here tell me to leave the corner in the end? That's Rabbi Shimon's question. Why is this different? Bishvil arba'a dvarim, for four reasons, Rabbi Shimon says. Amra Torah laniach pe'a besof sadeu. The Torah says to leave the corner at the end of your field. And the Gemara is going to say each and then explain them. So we'll read the heading and then we'll see the explanation. Mipnei, because of gezel aniyim, stealing from the poor. Umipnei bitul aniyim, and because otherwise it would force the poor to be unemployed, to waste time. Umipnei achashad, and because otherwise a person will be suspect. Umishum bal techale, and because the Torah says don't finish off your field. So we don't understand what any of those four are, right? Mipnei gezel aniyim, what does it mean? What did Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai mean not to steal the poor? Because let's say a guy is the owner of his field, he'll wait for a time that no one's around, the and then he'll call his relative who's poor and he'll tell him, he says, come here, I want to start harvesting my field now. You see this corner? This is Peya, you can have it. So then the other poor didn't have an equal opportunity to compete for that Peya. So in order to ensure that the one does not steal from the poor, that you don't play favorites, the Torah said you leave it at the end of the field. All the poor can forecast. They can see when you'll hit the end of the field. And so they can all be present. Umipnei bitul aniyim, and not to cause the poor to be unemployed. Shelo yu aniyim yoshvim umshalim achshav maniach balabait pe'ah. Because otherwise the poor would always have to sit down and wait. Ooh, maybe now he's going to start harvesting. Maybe now he's going to leave over the corner. Like this, they can see as you're harvesting, they could gauge what time to come back, and then they don't have to waste their whole day waiting for you to decide when you'll start and when you'll leave over the corner. They see you're systematically harvesting, they could gauge the time. It saves the poor a lot of time. They don't have to be necessarily unemployed. Yes? What about her? And therefore what?
It doesn't look like she go to the pe'ah.
Right. Why didn't Ruth go for pe'ah?
She was true, right. Was, I don't know
of an overt place where it says it, but what we do find is that Chazal tell us that Ruth did not fight with the other poor. Very often people would fight. That's mine. Ruth was always willing to give in. Pe'ah is an example of a time where the poor get a large amount in one shot. The Mishnah indicates that there were often fights over the pe'ah. It would make sense that a modest woman like Ruth wasn't fighting. It even says that you may not harvest the pe'ah with an instrument because we're scared people will hurt one another. Pe'ah must be taken by hand because the rabbis were concerned. You're standing there with the sickle. Hey, watch out, right? You know, I don't mean to hurt you, but I'm harvesting. So our sages said, no harvesting with a sickle, no harvesting with an instrument. So it could be that that's why Ruth, we don't find Ruth collecting pe'ah. That could be. So as a person wouldn't be suspect, so people walking by shouldn't say, people are going to see you finishing the harvest of your field. They weren't around when you started the harvest of your field. So if you're going to be allowed to leave over any one of the four corners, so then the passers-by are going to see you finishing off the harvest, and they're going to say, ooh, he should be cursed. What a guy. He doesn't give the poor, even the corner he doesn't leave for the poor. So the Torah wanted there should be a science here. There should be a system. You leave over pe'ah at the final corner of the field. So that, the Gemara says, that's the third reason. Now, in truth, Ein Yaakov skipped a few lines here in Talmud. The Gemara had said that if you have two alternate windows in your house and you're lighting Hanukkah candles in your house, so make sure to light on both sides so that if someone passes on one side, he shouldn't think, hey, this guy doesn't light any Hanukkah candles when you really lit on the other side. So then the Gemara asked, who says I should care about people suspecting me of doing something wrong? And the Gemara says, here, I'll show you a source that you should care. And that's really why the Gemara brought this braisa, to show us that we're concerned about chashad. You don't do things that will cause people to think you're doing something wrong. It says, if a non-Jew comes to pick up his items, we tell him, come before Shabbos. I don't want you to come to my house to pick up your stuff on Shabbos, because you're going to walk out with your CD player or your iPhone on Shabbos, and everyone's going to see, ooh, he walked into your house and took it. You made a sale on Shabbos. He's obviously taking it on your behalf. People are going to look and it's going to seem wrong. So don't do something that will cause people to think you're doing something wrong. That's the concept we learn here, and that we do agree with. That, yes?
Why is this generalized, this concept? Why isn't it just, okay, I'll bring you a place, so why doesn't the guy, so he brings the concept of pay up, and why isn't the response just like, that's for pay up? Why is it general?
Well, if the Torah tells me I should be concerned, so I can understand that that's a concern. Sometimes you say, I'm saying here you see a concept. You see, the Torah wanted, the Torah was concerned. People shouldn't think you did something wrong.
Yes, but why does one person have implications for another mitzvah that's seemingly unrelated?
Okay, so we have a concept called Binyan Av. We have a concept that says, if the Torah teaches me something, the assumption is it's a global rule. Wait. Step two, anytime you do a Binyan Av, what the Talmud's going to do next is say, wait, maybe the reason you have this rule with regards to this mitzvah is because this mitzvah is unique in that, and then the Talmud starts attacking it, taking it apart and saying maybe this mitzvah is unique because it has this component or that component, that's why it has the component we're trying to make a binyan av from. So that's true. That's what the Talmud will do. But the general rule is we do try to generalize, and then the Talmud attacks it and says, okay, prove it. I'm saying what you're asking is really that the Talmudic system would insist on proving that you can extrapolate. That's true. You're right. That's what the Talmud would do. You're right. I would add that we have another concept. When Moshe is instructing the 2.5 tribes that stay on the eastern side of the Jordan, he tells them, look guys, you want this large, fertile piece of land that's almost the size of the rest of Israel. We have to make a deal here. You guys have to go in and lead the way to war, and you have to help them conquer and divide. And after you're done with that, then you can come back home. And if you live up to your end of the deal, then v'yitem nikiyim me'Hashem u'me'Yisrael. Then you will have come clean of God and Israel. So Moshe tells them something. He doesn't just say come clean of God. He says, come clean of Israel. Meaning, the Jewish people are standing here thinking that you guys want to chicken out of war. The reason you want this territory is because you want to avoid another battle. You want to prove yourself right, you have to do what you agree with God. You also have to do it in a way that Israel is comfortable with you. And with that, our tradition is that Moshe Rabbeinu taught us a concept of Maris Ayin. It's not enough that a human being comes clean of God. A person also has to come clean of his fellow men. You know, we had a guy here who was a big joker. So he would pour himself, he worked in a laboratory. He would sneak over to the fridge, take one of those cups that are used for urine samples, pour in apple juice, walk to the lab and say, guys, I have a really sick patient in the other room. You guys have to stop everything you're doing and check this sample. And they'd say, but we're busy. And he'd say, okay, I'm going to have to diagnose myself and drink down the cup of apple juice. And he'd say, no, he seems healthy to me. Okay, never mind. I don't need you guys. Okay, now, that's not kosher, right? What are you doing? So all the lab guys would be ready to vomit, right? So if I'm going to do that, if a person's going to do something that seems wrong, that's not right. You know, the fact that he knows it's okay, that doesn't mean it's okay. You have to come clean of your fellow man too. Vitem nikin. Yeah, he's not with us anymore, but not from drinking apple juice. Okay. Yes. So coming back to here, so there is a question: is chashad synonymous with maris ayin? From that pasuk, v'yitam nikiyim elokim u'meisrael, we learn the din of maris ayin. Don't do something that seems wrong. You guys focused? Can we go a little bit deeper?
Yes.
Okay. So there is a Jerusalem Talmud. We know we have a mitzvah of Shemitah, right? On the year of Shemitah, and the next year is going to be Shemitah. Yeah, 5775. We're hitting the year of Shemitah. So during the year of Shemitah, you're not allowed to work the land. We say that we learn from the laws of Shabbos that it's not only plowing the land, but any action that would be beneficial to the land is also an adjunct of plowing. So you're not allowed to fertilize the land either here in Israel during the year of Shemitah. The Mishnah says, what if you want to store fertilizer in your field during Shemitah? So the Mishnah says, okay, you make heaps of fertilizer out there and everyone knows you're not fertilizing your field, right? Because you made a huge heap of fertilizer. Comes the Jerusalem Talmud and says, wait a second. But the first time, the first shovel, the first pile of fertilizer you take out there certainly seems like you're fertilizing the field. It's only 20 minutes later when you start seeing a pile that you understand he's not fertilizing his field, he's making a pile. So the Jerusalem Talmud teaches us a very important rule. The Jerusalem Talmud says, Maris Ayin takes into account that the person's going to see a broader picture. Because if all the person's seeing is a split second, then many things can seem improper. I'll give an example it doesn't say in the Jerusalem Talmud. Let's say you come to shul in the morning and you put on your tefillin on your arm. Maybe you should be worried someone's going to walk out and think you only put on tefillin on the arm and not on the head. You say, no, I assume, you know, he's going to see me do this, he's going to see me do that. I'm not worried about that. Many things taken out of context can look bad, can seem like Maris Ayin. So the Jerusalem Talmud expands it. It says, you're not worried about Maris Ayin because someone's only going to see a split second. The assumption is they're going to see a broader picture. That's the Jerusalem Talmud quoted by the Magen Avraham in the Laws of Shabbos pertaining to discussion of having a bathhouse open on Shabbos. We won't go that far. But it is quoted in Halacha. Give me just 1 second. I just want to point out that our Gemara seems to say something a little different. Our Gemara says we're concerned that people will see him finishing the harvest of the field and they won't have seen him starting the harvest. So they will not have seen the peah he left off an hour or 2 hours ago, but they will see him finishing the harvest. That's called chashad. So we have to wonder, is chashad and maris ayin the same thing? Right? The Gemara brings this as a source for chashad. And the other pasuk we discussed, V'itim nikim elokim u'meisrael, is a source for Maris Ayin. And now we had the Jerusalem Talmud that tells us about Maris Ayin, that I'm not so concerned, a person will see only a small segment. And here, with regards to Chashad, the Talmud tells me, I am concerned that they'll see the final minutes of harvest, and they'll think he did something wrong. So this is just food for thought. I see you guys are into going deep, so... Yes?
Two questions / points. First one, the Jerusalem Talmud, on the point it makes about someone not being worried about viewing someone seeing the entire interaction and only seeing a part of it. It seems like what it's not saying, but seems to be implying, is that it expects people to give a little bit of a benefit of a doubt. It seems to be implying that.
I hear. I have to think about it. I never thought of it that way. I hear you.
And the question, I
would just add a point to think about. Mm-hmm. Remember that in ancient times, people weren't flying by at 50 miles an hour. Life was calmer. There's a very interesting and boring book called Time Wars. It's not such interesting reading, but it is an interesting book where he discusses how the fact that we work with a watch causes us to work with a system that's far more exact, and we value time differently. If you're working with a sundial where you're always within a half-hour range, you make up with someone, I'll meet you noonish. No one expects you to be there on the minute. You got a half-hour leeway either way before you're considered early or late. So now we have these watches, suddenly we work by the minute. Then we end up by the second, and now we're dealing with nanoseconds. So... I'm just saying it could be the Jerusalem Talmud was working within a society where it was easier to assume that people would see more of an action. Today, much of our life is running at 50 miles an hour. So I'm not sure. I'm saying I hear what you're saying, I'm just not sure that's the reasoning behind the Jerusalem Talmud. Yeah, I'm with you.
So the question on Enyako is, was at the time that this Mishnah was discussed, was common practice to leave the last corner, or was the common, in other words, was it 25% for each corner, or was it like 80% people were leaving the last corner and only like 10-20% were doing one of the first three corners, and therefore if you waited and you saw someone was doing, didn't leave the last corner, it would be more of an assumption that he didn't leave the
I think the assumed understanding is that from the time of Yoshua, from the time we entered Israel onward, the peah was left at the end of the field. What Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is coming to explain is the reasoning behind this mitzvah. But it's not that people were doing something else. I'm oversimplifying it.
But if that was the standard, then you wouldn't necessarily think that that's more science.
I hear. So you're saying if the standard would change, people wouldn't think that way. But then maybe that contradicts your earlier assumption. Maybe part of Maris Ayin is an assumption that people will not give you the benefit of the doubt. Like I once said to my Rebbe, I said, I have a hard time buying into Maris Ayin because I want to give everyone else the benefit of the doubt that they'll give me the benefit of the doubt when they see me doing this. That was my argument as a kid. You know, I want to judge them favorably. Why should I assume they'll give me the... They'll judge me in favorably. So I guess that's part of the...
At a certain point, it reaches practicality.
What?
At a certain point, it reaches practicality, how things work in the real world.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Alex, you're going
to... Could it be, have something to do with the end of the task? Because on the one hand, you have the big pile, on the other hand, it's the end of the field, and there's no path.
Right. I was wondering that too, that maybe that's why the Jerusalem and Babylonian Talmud don't disagree. The Jerusalem Talmud is assuming you'll see a continuation of the task. That doesn't contradict what the Babylonian Talmud said. They'll watch you after that. They'll see from that minute onward. That doesn't mean they'll see the minutes earlier. So then you have to discern and say that perhaps there's a difference between assuming you saw the beginning to saying that if you see something troubling, so then before you call judgment, you'll stick around and wait and see if it's really the way you thought. Right. I agree with you. I agree that that might be a distinction between here and there. Agreed. Yeah, good point. Yeah. You guys are making me wish I was teaching you Talmud, not just Ein Yaakov. Okay.
Maybe you should.
Maybe, yeah.
In the morning.
Right. Atu kulu lo mishum bal techanenunu. So we said the final reason, mishum bal techale, the final reason seems to be funny. It says because the Torah says don't finish off your harvest. Isn't that the reasoning behind all of them? Amarava mitne aramayin. So Rava explained. It means in order to ensure that people actually keep this mitzvah. Because if it was a free-for-all where you could leave off the corner anywhere you wanted, so then anyone could say, oh, I already did it. And people would easily outsmart the system. So the Torah was concerned about that. The Torah said, you got to leave the end corner. That way people won't swindle the poor and take away their portion. Again, you guys want more depth? Or we'll move on. You want depth? So there are numerous points here that bother me. Technically, biblically, if you left off one stalk, you were yotze peya. We say it every morning. Eilu dvarim she'en lahem shi'u. The following things have no minimum volume. There's no minimum measurement. And the first one is peya. So the Torah tells you, leave off the final corner, because otherwise people will be deceitful, and they won't. But wait a second, according to the Torah, they could leave off one. Why wouldn't they leave off one? It's rabbinic that we say leave over 1/60th for the poor. So I have ideas, but I'm very bothered with the question. I have ideas that are chidushim. So I don't know. I'm just, when the Gemara says it, the Gemara says, we're worried that people are going to be deceitful. Yeah, to save one stalk. I don't know.
What is it in 1/60?
The Mishnah in Peya says. It begins by saying, Eil Dvarim Shein Lemshir, and then says, we have a rule in Peya, you're supposed to give. The rabbi said, give 1/60. That's a rabbinic institution. Yeah.
Of course, you can give more.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, what you just said is the continuation of the Mishnah. Yeah.
Is it also that also apply like peyot? So you also just have one like hair on the corner of your or
so the terminology when it comes to peyat harosh is lo takifu peyat roshechem. Lo takifu means don't complete the revolution of the hairline on your head. So you have a hairline that goes here. Those of you who still have hair, right? Okay. It's everyone but me here, okay? There's a hairline. And then there's a hairline here, right? So the Torah is saying you have the hairline behind your ear. You have the hairline by the widow's peak. In the front, the top of your forehead. The Torah says, lo takifu, don't complete that revolution around your head. So that means, if you have a hairline where hair stops growing, if you cut off your hair from this line downward, it doesn't matter with a razor or scissors, if you cut it real close and you shave that off, so then you have a complete hairline going down, a straight line going down. So that's why we say from the hairline down, you're not allowed to cut that short. Even with a shaver, you got to keep it long enough that you can fold the hair onto itself. Now, is there a minimum amount of hair that would constitute not completing the revolution around your head? Halachically, we say not. But there is a Rambam that we don't understand that does give a number. And we're not sure what that number is because there are different versions in the Rambam. So that's just that you're right in your direction of thought. There is such an opinion, which would give us a minimum number of hairs that would be okay. We don't really go with that. We don't even understand it. We don't even know the exact number. So our assumption is that these two peyot are not the same.
But could it be along a similar line that Amharic or whoever in Am Yisrael, they already give Shumal the Maestro a certain number of hairs, and the peyot beautification on
this. How do you see that peyah is a beautification?
Because perhaps perhaps the requirement to give one stock, the more that they're able to give, is a beautification of that mitzvah, similar to how people try to beautify the mitzvah online by going up there. It just seems to strike me, if the minimum is one stock, then maybe the expectancy was that there would be some. So that some people that go into an overabundance, similar, just because of the one choice alone. So
you're 100% right in the concept, meaning the Jerusalem Talmud over there on the first Mishnah of Peah says, why didn't the Mishnah list the spitting of a sota? This week's parsha, right? Doesn't say how much she should spit. So maybe she could spit twice. Maybe she could spit like a whole bunch of phlegm into his shoe. You know, enjoy that. Right? I said sota. I meant chalitza. Yeah. Thank you. When a man dies without children, his brother has a mitzvah to marry his sister-in-law. Not this week's parsha. I'm sorry. This week's parsha is sota. I said sota and I meant chalitza. So in chalitza, the woman spits into the shoe, and he, and that's a way of telling the brother-in-law, you know, what you did here is denigrable. Whatever. You guys will film. You know what I mean. So
she doesn't have to marry him if she does that?
If he doesn't want to marry her. Right. So then that's the process called chalitza, taking off of the shoe. Okay. So it doesn't say how much he has to spit. There has to be enough that you see that she spat. But maybe, you know, she could spit twice or spit up a lot. So the Talmud says, it gives a few examples like that. The Talmud says, no, we're talking about, it also brings the case of sota, how much earth do you put into the water. So the Talmud over there says that our Mishnah listed things which you're fulfilling a mitzvah when you give more. Peah, well, let's see. Let's take the cover of the jacket of this book, okay? If I do this, that's a small corner. If I do this, that's a bigger corner. They're all a corner. What size corner am I supposed to give of the field? Maybe all of this should be the corner. It's still a corner. You know, you do a right angle on the corner, you end up having a bigger or smaller corner. It's all a corner. Okay. Again, if you want, we can discuss it, but it's a much broader discussion. So at any rate, coming back to our idea, we do find in Talmud the concept you just said, that the mitzvah of Peah is enumerated in the Mishnah because the more you give, the bigger a mitzvah you've done. But to say that that's why they were worried the people would steal from it, I need to think about it. I don't know. I need to think about it. We got 2 minutes left, so once we've done our whole class in depth, I'll add one more point of depth that Nachum just pointed out to me. I hadn't thought of it earlier. The Mishnah says, Le'olam u'noten mishum pe'ah. You could always give off a corner. If you finish the harvest, you could give off a corner from the crop that's piled up. You made it into bread. You could take off a corner of the bread and you could give it to the poor. So, I just realized that even though the mitzvah of Peah is really when the crops are standing, and if a person finished harvesting the crops and he did not give off Peah, he transgressed the biblical commandment, because it says, Lo techale, don't finish off the corner when you're harvesting your field. If he did, he transgressed that. But what I realized from your question, I never thought of it that way, is that technically within the Trumos and Maisos, and he's really dealing with a crop which potentially has Peah in it. Where is this relevant? I'll tell you a big secret now. People don't realize this. It's relevant in all the food you guys eat. When you eat bread or when you eat any fruit you're buying here in Israel, I am unaware of any farm that gives Peah today. Pretty shocking, isn't it? We're all so careful about Trumos and Maestros. But what about Leket Shikhan Peah? So we have this whole system, right? We have these huge machines that harvest our fields. But no one gives Peah, and they haven't been giving Peah for over a millennium. Now, no one knows why. We have all kinds of reasons that are given by the different commentaries, but it's basically to answer up for why we don't have the custom of giving Peah. But according to what I just realized from your question, being that when we do give over the tithes, the different portions to the poor, we can't be exact. So it's nice to think that maybe we fulfilled our obligation of peah there. Because you could give peah later on, even as bread. But that's just something you caused me to think about. Okay, what did we learn today? Let's recap. We said we have this big machlokas, whether darshin and time and dekra. Can we understand the reasoning of a mitzvah where the Torah did not give us the reasoning? Can that reasoning have halachic implications? We said anytime we encounter Rabbi Shimon in Shas Mishnayis, it's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. He is of the opinion we can give such reasonings. We gave the classical example of a widow. And then we went into our Gemara, four reasons why Peah is left at the end of the field. Stealing from the poor, he'll call his relative and give him the Peah. Wasting Nanim's time. Chashad, and then we went into the whole din of Chashad. We quoted the Jerusalem Talmud. We discussed the idea of bringing in fertilizer into the field. The Chiddush of the Jerusalem Talmud, we don't assume a person will only see a segment of the time, rather the full thing. We discussed Chashad, which might be different over here. We discussed the Pasuk of Yitim Nikim Elokim Israel, become clean of your fellow man as well. And finally, people shouldn't curse him and assume that he didn't leave over from the field, and that's why it's left over. Then we went into a discussion of the idea that you can really give Peah after you've harvested as well, and that the biblical obligation is just to leave one stalk. Everything else is rabbinic. We also discussed the Jerusalem Talmud, that the Mishnah only enumerates those things which you get a bigger mitzvah when you give more of, like Peah. The more you give, the bigger the mitzvah, and it would seem the bigger the biblical mitzvah. So,